Hello, dear downstream listener. Before the show gets started, I wanted to make an announcement. Our next episode, which will come out at the end of April, is going to be the last episode of Downstream. I have to work on some other projects, and I just don't have time for all the things in my calendar. And, you know, quite frankly, as much as I love talking about TV and about streaming, and I have enjoyed talking about it with Tim Goodman and Joe Adalian and Will Carroll and, of course, Julia Alexander, the fact is it's far enough out of the ballpark of what I usually cover that it makes covering it a lot harder and a lot of extra work. And I've got some other projects that I need to work on. And so I'm going to step aside. So thank you so much for listening to Downstream. I hope you enjoy this episode and the last episode that we'll do in a couple of weeks. It's really been great to hear from so many of you at downstreamfeedback.com over the years. Some of you go back to the TV talk machine. I really appreciate you listening to me talk with some really smart people about television. And maybe I'll find a way to talk with Joe and Will and Tim and other people again someday, but not for a while anyway. On to other things. Thank you so much for listening. And now please enjoy this episode of Downstream. From Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode 116, recorded April 17th, 2026. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and I am joined once again by Joe Adalian, West Coast editor at Vulture and author of the Buffering newsletter. Joe, thank you and welcome back to Downstream.
Mr. Snell, Mr. Jeopardy, good to talk to you, sir.
It's been a month because I got sick 2 weeks ago and so we skipped. I was on Jeopardy. I mean, there it is. I was on the TV and then I was on Hulu and Peacock for 5 days because as our listener, I'm just going to bring this up to the top. Listener Ben wrote in and said, hello from the 209. I was excited to finally have the time to sit down with my family and watch Jason's appearance on Jeopardy. When to my dismay, I learned Sony only keeps the 5 latest episodes available. How can I keep an eye out for your return to streaming? And what could be behind Sony's strategy here? Is it a play to keep the audience focused on what's new so it can keep going? Love to your mothers. Their streaming strategy, I mean, it's great that they're on Hulu and Peacock, but it is a little bit curious, right? It's like,
well,
blink and you miss it.
Well, it's honestly, it's meant to do a couple things. It's one, to drive urgency, right? You know, if they want you to be in a habit, as do the streamers,
they want to create a daily habit on streaming.
Right. So that you don't say, oh, I'm just going to binge, you know, 20 episodes. But, you know, the gentleman that you played against, I don't know if he still has a streak, but he had a streak.
He's the fifth best of all time.
Like you, it's like if you're not going to win at Jeopardy, that's the best way to not win at Jeopardy. But notice I didn't use the L word because you did L, but you didn't just not win. But anyway, and you know, so there's part of that, but it's also honestly, I think that could change over time. But essentially, it's because Sony is making sure not to annoy its partners in local TV, because local TV stations are still the ones who supply the most money to Sony for Jeopardy. It's a huge, big, it's highly rated show. Yeah. They don't want to risk people, those numbers going down any further. And by the way, as far as I can tell, it hasn't gone down this season at all that much. So it's working, and which makes sense because, you know, what Disney has recognized with, for example, Dancing with the Stars is you can stream something live on Disney Plus and live on ABC. And guess what? It's not going to hurt the ABC numbers. In fact, the ABC numbers went up last season because there's a different audience that watches still on traditional TV than streaming. But, you know, so they don't want to piss off their partners in local TV. And if you have too many episodes, then it's a feeling of, oh, well, it's not really special. Why do I ever need to keep local TV?
Exactly.
And also, but you know, it's also why a local TV bundle is good, because if you have a YouTube TV or something, you can just record the show and keep it for 9 months.
Exactly. And I think, yes, the idea that the streaming is not like a comprehensive streaming strategy. It's a compromise to get them on streaming to reach cord cutters, but they are trying to keep, just as you said, they kind of want to keep the strip syndication 5 days a week pace, which is why they only keep 5.
As long as they can, right?
And if you could pile up, if Hulu had, you know, all 90 episodes or something, you would have zero motivation to, one, watch on local TV, or two, keep watching every day, right? Like, that's the goal. So it's more of a kind of like catch-up, cord-cutter, alternative method rather than something larger. But it is true that I did hear from a few people who are like, oh no, I missed your window because after, you know, a week, my episode disappeared.
I do think five is a ridiculously small amount.
I agree too.
Especially with streaks. I think they should figure something out. And they might. They'll see how the deals go, see how local stations feel. I'm sure the next thing, and, you know.
Those episodes go fast. Like, even if you put 10 or 15, it's not the same. I mean, it's just, it's not, they're still going to roll off. It allows you to go on vacation and come back and kind of get caught up. And it feels a little too strict, but I get it. I get what they're doing.
Especially when people have DVRs, you know, who still have cable, and it's sort of like, you know, do you really, again, Sony also, everyone has as an incentive to keep that system as going as long as possible because they make more money from it.
That's true.
What I wonder is, I wonder what this has meant for YouTube dubs, or I don't know how they. Sony's pretty darn aggressive at chasing.
Yeah, you like can they find will, them, they, but then you they can disappear. Find them,
but then they disappear because they have takedowns. I mean, they'll if you're a fan of classic soap operas like Days of Our Lives, which Sony distributes, they will hunt down a 1985 episode of Days of Our Lives, or sometimes with $25,000 Paramount, which they also own the rights. I'm like, seriously, guys, you're not syndicating this any other way. But they'll still. Sony is just very aggressive.
So listener Ben. I'm not going to say why, but send me an email.
He has methods. Yes. Or you could wait for the rerun because there might be a rerun this summer.
Might be. I mean, hopefully. You never know. That ours was a good game against a super champion. So we may get a repeat. That would be great.
And you'll be at some point, you'll be part of a collection. What's the guy's name?
Jamie Ding. Jamie Ding game five. And ours is one of the better games, actually. So I think we might be. It's possible. Might be in there.
Exactly.
It was a real team effort. The woman I was on with, Jordan, we both played pretty well, but, you know, that guy. Anyway, speaking of Jeopardy, actually, and streaming strategies, Pop Culture Jeopardy is coming back. In fact, one of the reasons there was like a month between my tape date and my air date, which is very tight for them. They don't like to keep it that close, but they had just shot season two of Pop Culture Jeopardy on the stage, on the Alex Trebek stage. So they did not have, they kind of ran out of padding and then had to fill the container with more Jeopardy rapidly after they were done with that. But Pop Culture Jeopardy is back on season two, but it's not on Prime Video. It's on Netflix. And you got to report. I love this. I love that this is part of your beat. You got to report on how they're doing it. Netflix is going to release Pop Culture Jeopardy daily.
Daily, yes. No, I broke the story this week of Netflix sort of doing, you know, so it's a, you know, it's for, if you're a Pop Culture Jeopardy fan, you know, your show's coming back in, I think it's May 13th, or right around May, I forget the date. And there are going to be 20 episodes this season, not 40 like we had for Amazon. So it's going to be a smaller commitment, a smaller season. They're also changing up the format. But the real interesting from a streaming point of view is that Netflix is going to do out new episodes Monday through Friday, and they've never done that with sort of a long run sort of original entertainment original, which this is because it's a Netflix original now, produced by Sony, but still a Netflix original. Mm-hmm. Now they've done something close to it with talk shows. John Mulaney's talk show limited series, his first one, was a 7-day limited series event, tied to the Netflix is a Joke comedy festival. And that did sort of go like Friday through the next month, Thursday or whatever. It was like limited things. So they did that. And back in the day, Chelsea Handler had a talk show that had episodes like three times a week that came out every day. But this is the first time for a month, basically. It's how many episodes they're going to run for 4 weeks. They're doing it daily. And it's really interesting and refreshing. And they're not saying we have any plans to do more, but they told me, my sources there, that they're open to it with the right idea. And I think what they do want, you know, they look at an example of how this can work sometimes is something like Love Island on Peacock. Which airs, you know, basically almost an episode every day for about a month, 5 weeks, and it gets people coming to Peacock again and again and again. Netflix doesn't have that problem as much. For a lot of people, it's still an app that they open every day. I don't, but a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But this is another way to get people who are really into a show the chance to come back if they really like it every day. It could also potentially, if the episodes are good, build some buzz as people talk about the episodes. And it lets them build some data to see like, well, what if we had a long-running Netflix-only game show? What if we revived, you know, Card Sharks or Sale of the Century, or more likely something new that appealed to people under 30? It gives them some, you know, some data, which they love over there at Netflix. to sort of see, like, will people watch a daily show on Netflix? And I think they will. And they've also done this, by the way, Jason, with the podcast that they're doing. They're essentially doing daily talk. You know, not all these podcasts aren't always daily, but a lot of them are. I think wouldn't the guy from The Ringer, Bill Simmons, doesn't he come on almost every day? I think.
I don't know. Yeah. You can have a different, I mean, with podcasts, you can have a different pace. But I think pace is part of, and creating habits. I mean, look, they're kind of preaching to the choir here, because you and I have said this for a long time.
Years.
The idea that, you know, that the old TV model had a lot of benefits. One of the benefits of the old TV model was a rhythm, and the idea that, for example, one might watch Pop Culture Jeopardy first and then move on to a show or a movie or something, and have it be this little bite-sized thing that you have before you do something else every day, and you make a little bit of a habit of it. That's not bad. Like, making a habit of it is a big part of the game when it comes to streaming. You want everybody to make habits about opening that app and then watching this show and then moving on to the next thing. And I certainly worth a try, but I'm kind of a believer in it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth a try. And, it's another way to, you know, get people into the show. And they are changing the format, and so the episodes are going to be the first 3 weeks are going to be sort of self-contained, as sort of Jeopardy style, as opposed to the old one where it was more tournament style. And so I think that is also a good thing that lets people just tune in when they want to. And then there's a tournament at the last week. I think it's worth experimenting. I think Sony will be looking too, because, you know, at some point, you know, I Sony isn't planning for it now, but at some point it would not surprise me if these shows become same day on streaming somewhere, and someone's going to pay a lot of money. And Netflix also probably wants to see, well, you know, when the next bid comes up for real Jeopardy rights, how much are we going to pay? Well, now we'll get some data to see what sort of habit it can establish. Although, of course, Pop Culture Jeopardy, it's I know Jeopardy, it's a friend of mine. Pop Culture Jeopardy, you're no Jeopardy classic, but it's still an interesting show. Yes, especially if you're over the age of 45 or so, because the problem was, I think we've talked about before, with Pop Culture Jeopardy was it's made for the youngs.
Well, if they do a third season, I'll apply, but I'll be applying with my daughter, because there's part of it I get and part of it I do not get, so. Because I'm aging out of that category, much to my sadness, but that's just how it is. Well, I like that they're trying it, and it's the Jeopardy brand is kind of going wild right now. They did a YouTube episode with YouTube creators, which was like a little truncated episode, but they did that as a way to launch their more content on their YouTube platform. I know they're experimenting with Substack. They're doing that too. They have their ABC seems fairly happy with the deal where they run a couple of prime time events over the course of the season, Jeopardy Masters and the Celebrity Jeopardy, which is going on right now.
And it's doing very well, by the way. I talked to the ratings guy over there, and they're just, some of the numbers on Friday it does really, really well.
Right. And I mean, this is network TV now, is you really want a lot of reality, and game shows are a really cheap, and I've said that being in the studio, and it's very impressive, but still ultimately, as television goes, a very cheap way to put time on prime time. So
yeah.
I'm glad it's doing numbers for them too.
What I continue to be irritated though about is that Jeopardy, or that Sony, which, you know, seems to be against anything before the 2000s, you know, with especially Jeopardy, but especially also Wheel of Fortune, they have so very few episodes available that from the first 5-10 years of the show, like especially with Wheel of Fortune, when they had the shopping and everything was so much more fun, like those episodes, like they took them off Pluto where they had them for a while, and so, like, it's just, I don't understand, why do you not have those episodes available? I don't know if it was a Pat Sajak thing. Well, Pat's off the show now, so, like, let us see the classic Pat episodes. I don't know.
I do wonder if they just worry that it's too much of a good thing and they want to focus people on the televised syndication, or on prime time, or on the streaming. But I agree. They've done some curated packages. They're a lot of fun. It's fun to watch old Alex Trebek episodes. It's fun to watch. They have the Ken Jennings, you know, greatest hits run up there now. That's a lot of fun to watch. And I think you're right that in a fast environment, to be able to kind of just, if not algorithmically close to it, just be able to put on Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy or whatever, and whatever they serve up is fine. Like, I think that's pretty good. I think
it's not a bad thing, but I also just specifically have a problem with them sort of, even in the offerings they do have the collections, it's all mostly like the late 90s and on. And I feel like that's really what it is, basically. It's saying like, well, we want to reach the younger viewers who maybe don't want to show that's not in HD, or they don't understand some of that, or it looks a little funky.
I would love to watch somebody go shopping with Chuck Woolery.
Oh, exactly. Or with the early episodes from Pat.
Yep.
And they did have that for a while. There were a few episodes and I watched them with Peacock, and then they took them off when they went the new deals, or maybe they're back on, I don't know. But certainly the packages that they did for Hulu and Peacock don't have the older episodes. And what's really annoying is, on the other hand, Fremantle, which is the biggest supplier of classic game shows, they do Price is Right, which is also like Jeopardy, still very active, very vital, a big part of CBS's daytime schedule, big primetime show as well. They have primetime specials that do well. They're going to do a primetime edition live of Price is Right. I don't know how much better that will be, but it'll be Drew Carey live. But they actually, Fremantle has two fast channels. Yeah. The Drew Carey years, the Bob Barker years. And they go back to the 80s. And you know what? The audience finds it. So you got it there. Choose. I get that people who are in their 30s don't probably care as like we do about the shopping, but there's an audience there that'll watch.
And it's so memeable for those who don't know and are still listening to us talk about game shows. It used to be that you had money at the end of your round of Wheel of Fortune, and then there were like the prizes, like you'd have on The Price is Right. There was like a space with all these things, and you went shopping, and so you'd say, you know, for $800, I'll take the TV. For $150, I'll take the blender. And then, but you had to spend all of it until there was nothing left that you could buy, and you could put the rest on a counter or gift certificate. And so in the end, invariably, there was some terrible thing that nobody wanted. And they're like, all right, for $50, I'll take the ceramic swan.
Ceramic Dalmatian. Ceramic Dalmatian, that's the actual name. There's a YouTube channel, used to be called Ceramic. It might still be there. You can look some episodes. Ceramic Dalmatian, because yes, the Ceramic Dalmatian was the pinnacle
there'll be some good memes about that, at least. I don't know. I share your frustration in general that we finally have the technology to put everything that's ever been on television available for somebody to watch if they want to find it. And we're not doing it.
or if we're doing it, it really is. And I think a lot of streaming decisions get skewed by data from the, you know, mid-aughts or early 2010s, when the first adapters of streaming were millennials who were young. And they obviously, it's why Friends became big, because they were there. Well, streaming is much bigger and much older and broader than it used to be. And yet the priors haven't been corrected. And that, to me, frustrates me. Even CNN, another example of this, a random one, and then I'll get off this. My BS. CNN is putting up old episodes of Larry King Live on its app and streaming semi-service. It's a horrible streaming service, but whatever. If you're a linear subscriber to CNN on cable, you can get these too. And they're great. They're doing 10 episodes every week of Larry King Live's talk show. But this is a guy who was on CNN from 1985 to 2010, right? And the last 5 years, you know, he was basically phoning it in. He was barely there. I mean, he was still Larry, but he was like not the top of his game, right? So once you know what the first 10 episodes they put up this week, 7 out of the 10 come from 2005 to 2010. Nothing comes from the 80s, and only three shows come from the mid 90s. Sort of like, come on, CNN. Yeah. The whole point of a nostalgia show like that, you want to savor some of that. But guess what? If you're subscribing to CNN's app, or you're getting CNN through cable, you're probably getting colonoscopies on the regular. Maybe you should sort of have some shows from the 80s too. But they don't.
Give people stuff to watch when they're recovering from their colonoscopy.
Exactly. And I want to see a Whoopi Goldberg interview from 1985, not from 2008.
I hear you. We want to talk about Netflix a little bit more, just to say they're going to do a vertical video feed, and Reed Hastings was so offended that he quit. No, that's not what happened.
No, that's exactly what happened.
But yes. Reed Hastings, the co-founder of Netflix, is stepping down. He has already stepped away. He was just like executive chairman or whatever.
It's symbolic.
What an interesting trajectory, and what a fascinating business. And the what will go down in history, I think, is the pivot, the moment where the DVD in the mail service figured out that the internet was now fast enough that they could make things available for, I believe it was called instant watching back in
the day. Exactly. And how much of Reed sort of probably knew that that was coming, but he started the DVD business. I mean, from what I can sense, and maybe I'm wrong on this, maybe not when they first started, was it 1990? So in the early mid-90s, right, I think. So they may not have realized high-speed internet was going to be that soon when they first did it. But like, I think they stuck to it because at some point, well before the time when they flipped the switch, they were keeping the DVD business strong because they knew they were gaining all sorts of data. And in fact, as Ted has famously said, it informed their decision to do House of Cards, which, again, I think was sort of BS. It was just an interesting project that came out there.
You dropped a decade. It was 2007.
Only 2007 then Netflix? No, that was instant. But Netflix by mail was before 2007.
You're right. 97 by mail, 2007 instant watch.
And I think I've read
some
stuff.
Yeah, you're right. Because in the very early 2000s, as video stores started to fade, you could just do Netflix.
Right. I don't know if Reed was so visionary that he knew what happened as fast as it did, but I have a sense that even when he started DVD the business, they had to have known that.
Yes.
Oh, because by then people were streaming video. Yes. He was enough of to say, like, eventually we'll have it. I think the whole thing is, in some ways, I really think, you know, and I need to read. It was a Trojan horse, though, to some degree.
I think he and who everybody involved with that, they were building that business knowing that the internet was enabling this technology and that they could understand the data but they weren't able to do streaming. So what they did was this kind of amazing logistical challenge to have the DVDs come in the mail and all of that. But they built up a catalog, they built up a database, they built up a user base, and then they started having you do things like rate what you liked and didn't like so that they could make suggestions to you, which means they started to build an algorithm.
Yep.
And then I remember very clearly when they, you know, that first instant watch offering and then the first box, which was the Netflix box, which was actually what we now think of as Roku. It's a company that made it, but it did was play Netflix when it came out. It was a little plastic box you hook up to your TV and
played that
Netflix instant watch. That's what it did. You could watch Lilyhammer or whatever. So the other story is that they, like Disney and ESPN and everybody else, they're going to make like a vertical video feed thing, like a TikTok like thing to try and, you know, get in, reach young people on their phones with stuff.
Jason, I need to hold on a second. I need to pick my eyeballs because they rolled out of my head because I was rolling my eyes so hard at that.
I
mean, it's you know, I said this to my editors when we were talking about this. I'm biased. I've hardly ever used a mobile app of any of these major streaming services. I guess I'm not of that certain age. I'm not watching that on my phone. Sorry.
Yeah.
But it makes some sense. Maybe, I don't know. But the whole vertical thing of trying to compete with YouTube, TikTok, YouTube makes sense. YouTube is very much a short, it's a lot, the type of shows, you know, as they're sort of pivoted towards the living room experience, it would make sense that they do shorts, and shorts have been successful. Instagram, obviously, very visual. But, you know, I just don't know that Netflix is, or Peacock. Peacock, by the way, is doing a lot of investment in this as well. They're having a whole Bravo Metaverse or whatever they're calling it with, you know, Andy Cohen and AI and watching a scroll, and maybe that'll get some traction. I don't know. It sounds like a stretch to me. I feel like people only have so much bandwidth. And if TikTok and YouTube and Instagram are filling it, like, I don't know.
Yeah, it feels to me like a very, you know, how do you do, fellow kids kind of thing, where even Netflix, it's going a little too far for them. I feel that way about the ESPN verts and all of that. It's like there are places where vertical video kind of works, but I'm not sure that you are the place for it. But I get why they feel like they got to try it because they don't want to be left behind. But I am very skeptical.
Yeah. But, you know, you never know how things will evolve. And just to circle back to Reed, I mean, when you just think of the key genius of Netflix was that it was a tech company before it was a programming company.
Yes.
And when they became a programming company that actually started making shows, they kept the tech strong and vital. And all that work that they did in, as you said, using technology to make delivery of DVDs so fast and seamless, and that paid off when they then developed an app. Because even to this day, no app, no video app, you know, that streaming platform loads as quickly as Netflix, is most reliable as Netflix, that just works, that is the interface, because they did all that. And that's why people fear. That's what I think our friend, young David Ellison, you know, who's brought in someone from Google, and they're going to redesign Pluto and redesign Paramount Plus. And you know, it's good. They're spending the money, but it's not going to be easy to duplicate the 20 years or so that Netflix has been working on this. And it's really important.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Paramount, they had their upfronts. David Ellison said, oh, we're going to make 30 movies a year. And yeah, sure. But he also said that they're going to merge the Paramount Plus and Pluto tech stacks. What will happen to HBO Max? I guess later. Find out. But that is, you know, he did his thing where he got to stand up there and say, oh, I love Hollywood and I produced a bunch of movies and it's all going to be great. But from a streaming perspective, the visibility of Pluto was interesting, I thought.
Yeah, no, they've signaled this for a while. And when they first took over Paramount, well, everyone was saying, oh, Skydance is going to get rid of Pluto and whatever. And then there is going to be at some point, I think, some sort of merger between Paramount Plus and Paramount or and Pluto, yeah. and there'll be sort of one app, but they're not at first. They're just going to do it on the behind the scenes stack, which makes a lot of sense. Pluto was so horribly mismanaged by the old Viacom people. You know, they were very smart in that they bought Pluto before Fox bought Tubi, or you know, Amazon briefly got into the business. You know, and others. They saw the power of FAST. So they bought Pluto for a song, and it was great. But then they pivoted so quickly to focusing just on Paramount Plus, they just neglected this big, giant opportunity of free TV. And that's why you saw when Nielsen first started measuring streaming views, like Pluto was like easily the number one FAST platform. But very quickly, you know, Tubi just surpassed it because Fox just kept focusing on it. They let it do its thing. They invested in it. They also pivoted to making Tubi all about Tubi from day one was always about video on demand. Pluto was about a linear experience, which worked. And it's nice. And a lot of people do like that sort of clicking on when you go to Pluto. It's just linear TV or, you know, it's just like you're going through a cable thing. They're going to sort of downsize that and focus on what people seem to really want, which is the chance to sort of scroll endless roles and find shows. So we'll see if it works. But I think it's a good way to sort of promote the offering of Paramount Plus by having this sort of free homepage, which is going to be Pluto.
I have a couple kind of quick items. I'll just peek behind the scenes. Joe saw this one in the rundown. He was like, oh God, no. So, you know, it happened a few weeks ago and we didn't get a chance to cover it because I was sick. In 2 weeks ago, but like Bob Iger's big deal with OpenAI to be on like Sora and license all their characters so that people could make AI stuff with them. Well, OpenAI gave up on Sora. Disney means, I guess, Disney's investment gets to come back to them, or they'll work together on something else. It's just another little footnote in the second Bob Iger run of weird things that he did that we'll look back on and be like, what? He did that? But it's not going to happen because Sora is not a thing and it got dumped by OpenAI, and so much for that Hollywood ambition of
exactly
AI video generation
along with vertical video. But I do, there has been some talk that, oh, well, maybe they might think some other ways. And it's just, you know, I got an email today from Starbucks letting me know that I could now go into ChatGPT and design my dream Starbucks drink. And I'm like, all right, this is clearly a bubble, people, because I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't need AI to tell me how I can make the life of a barista even more hellish than it already is. So, but that's these companies, you know, they just, like you said, they're all afraid of missing out. And, you know, I don't mean to sound anti-AI, even though I'm not a big fan, but it has its uses. But I just don't know if Disney needs to be.
This is part of the AI hype cycle. Okay, my other item. So the Pitt. The final episode of the second season was last night. I still love it. I really enjoy it. And I love that they're making this kind of television on streaming, 15 episodes. They'll be back next January with another 15 episodes. Great. All great. I do have a funny note as well, because HBO Max has finally launched in the UK, and it's one of the places where The Pitt has just not been available. So they launched. They do have more global ambitions for HBO Max. So The Pitt season one is out in the UK. I think what is interesting, though, is they are launching season two weekly cadence, 13 weeks behind the US. So they're going to make, they're not going to let people binge season two in the UK. They got to watch it weekly.
I missed that. Well, good for them for doing that, because you know what? Let them experience Pitt the way God and John Wills intended it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
I don't want five hours of the Pitt in a row. I don't. Once a week is plenty. I love it, but like, I don't need more of it.
Yeah. When I got the screeners a year and a half ago, whenever it was, when it first came out, I stopped after three because A, it was just too intense. But B, I said, it's like, I like this show so much. I want to watch this weekly.
Savor it.
And I'm going to. You know, unfortunately, some of my colleagues don't have the opportunity because they've got to do features. If you go on to Vulture, by the way, great feature from my colleague, Catherine Van Andre.
It's a great story.
Who, all about that final, how they made it. And it's just amazing how that team works. And yes, I also love the Pitt, and people will find things to nitpick. And, you know, criticism is great. I think the more people love a show, the more they're going to pull it apart. And that's fine. It's got a broad audience, and they can certainly, you know, not everything is always going to be the right call, depending upon your taste. But
yep.
I'm just so glad we have it, and I cannot wait until January.
I read a great story about how internet fandom is broken, which I think we already knew, but the Pitt is a good example of it, where people are trying to analyze the Pitt using tools that were built for shows that are not the Pitt.
Yes.
And the one that gets me, and there are a lot of them, but the one that really gets me is how there seems to be a group of fans who are just perplexed by the fact that Dr. Robbie, Noah Wiley, the hero, does things that aren't good. And they're like, but that's bad. Like, yeah. The idea that a show would take its protagonist and have them do things that are bad and not be endorsing that behavior, but saying like, yeah, he just did a bad thing. That there are fandoms that are like, they don't understand how that could be.
Well, and then there's another fandom, and maybe this is more of a fandom or critic class, who looks at the bad things he does and says, why is the show endorsing this? But also, but like, why doesn't it judge him? And like, he should at least say it's wrong, but like, he's still right. And is that good? It's like, well, he's the hero. It's like, it's... So it is, you know, I don't want to dismiss anyone's concerns. Everyone has a right to critique however they want to. I think part of the problem is we pay attention to them. There's the fandom, and then there's the fact that people like, let people talk, let them, I don't have to pay attention. I don't need to do a story about it. I'm not dismissing some of those stories, and some of them are good. And I disagree with some of our own critics, and whatever publication I've been at, I'll sometimes disagree with critics. If I love a show, I love it. But you know, it's interesting.
I'll put a link in the show notes to this piece about the Pitt versus fandom, which includes some amazing,
art?
Yeah, well, it's like,
oh, remember
the water park slide collapse and how we thought the ER was going to overflow with victims and it just didn't, and then that plot line was completely done? Like, gasp. It went against your... Or the weakest aspect of the writing in the Pitt season two is we only have two episodes left and we still don't know the name of the Pitt Fest shooter from season one. It's like, they're not going to give that to you, folks. But they're looking for a show. And I think this is the challenge. In fact, Noah Wiley said something about this that's quoted in this story, which is, and he's trying to be really nice, but what he says is there are people who are watching the show and then imagining what the show will be. Well, here it is. I'll read what he said. He said, I think audiences have become sophisticated in a whole new way when they watch a show. They're watching the show we're making, and then they have another show that they're making. And when that show doesn't align with the show you're making, they don't like it as much because they thought you were taking it where they're taking it. So they have their own fictions and offshoots and relationships that they are narrating in real time with the one we're doing. It's fascinating to watch, which the writer says that's putting it diplomatically. But I think that is one of the best observations about internet fandom I have ever seen from Noah Wiley, because it's the show that's in your head and the show that's on the screen. Right. And you get to be the showrunner of the show that's in your head, which means you start complaining when the show on the screen and the decisions of the actual showrunner do not match your decisions.
And I think that's probably always to some degree been a bit a thing in people, but we just didn't have the social media so everyone can share their opinions. And then you didn't have hungry for clicks websites who then can click and make it a thing. And it just, you know, it becomes this whole social loop and then people get upset and they refer. You know, what it does show is that this is a show people care passionately about. And you see it also in things with, like, I'll bet you 10 to 1, you agree with me, maybe I'm wrong, but you very much would love to see the Pitt Night Shift. I want to see the Nightcrawler. I want to see more because I love this show. I love these characters. They've created such rich characters. And by the way, the show's format limits it. I'm also, look, in my own sort of older guy TV reporter type thing, you're thinking, well, you know, that's the limitations of real time. And it's true. They only get to do one day. ER was so great because it allowed you to see, like, there was the, this is a tiny spoiler, this point. If you haven't watched the Pit finale, what are you doing? But, you know, there's a mid-credit scene of them out there doing karaoke, right? Yeah. And people went crazy for that because we got to see the doctors out in the environment. Well, you got to do that every week on an ER, many weeks on an ER, right?
That's true.
And that was a show that was great because it was more traditional on TV. That's not what the Pit is. They're making this show. And yes, as much as I sometimes think, because I'm an amateur producer in my head, you know, I might have industry experience and talking to executives and blah, 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 and looking at ratings. So part of me thinks, oh, it'd be so much better if they did this, but that's not the show they're doing. Yeah. And the creators are doing what they want. And, you know, I do think, do you agree that the show, I don't see if we can find the right creative team to sort of whatever. I think, I joked last night on Blue Sky that, you know, CBS in 2027 will debut the Pit Nightcrawlers
We have what? There's Chicago Fire and Chicago Med and Chicago mm-hmm. Police or whatever, and like and all the Law and Orders over the years and all the CSIs over the years. I mean, this is one of those areas where the Pit wants to be a network TV show, but not too much, which is kind of funny because it's like if you were on CBS, there would be two more of the Pits, right? Like they would already be being developed. And
yes.
I don't know if the Night Shift is the right model or not, but it strikes me that if the show is going so well, if you could increase your writing staff and your production staff, you could give your LA-based crew more work at a time when there are very few productions actually happening in California. Yeah. And, you know, not have to use the same cast except for some crossover. And you could tell the story across, let's say, 24 weeks instead of 15.
Right. And why, a million things.
Maybe
why
so.
Not? Well, yeah. And it depends on, and in streaming, you know, in network, you do it because you want to have three shows on a night and everything. Here, you could have it, Max could contribute so that it's, you know, basically keep people subscribed for 30 weeks, yeah, 32 weeks, you
exactly.
know, there are ways to do it. And the CBS part I mentioned is, of course, if unfortunately the Warner Brothers Paramount merger goes through, suddenly CBS will be part of the same corporation that owns HBO Max. And in the same way that Marshalls is the biggest hit on network TV right now, which is a spinoff of the Yellowstone universe, which has powered Paramount Plus for the last 5 years, and then before that Paramount Network, well, you could see that sort of maybe working. The problem, of course, is how much, you know, because of the HBO patina, even though it's not an HBO show, it's an HBO Max show,
right.
You know, they won Best Emmys. Like, do they want to, and you know, they sort of, even though these are network, I mean, I didn't realize that Scott had run like an NCIS show for like a decade until I found out that Scott is also going to be working on the pilot for NCIS New York because he worked on NCIS LA. I didn't realize that, but this is a guy who knows network TV. So you know what? He could oversee. He can, you know, does he want to split? He doesn't have to split his focus as much as maybe after three seasons, he could sort of move on and let someone be day to day on the Pit. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't want to hurt the mothership.
I will say, whether it's the obvious one or it's some other angle, I would be surprised if there isn't something like from the producers of the Pit, it's about a shift of, let's say, paramedics. And maybe they're even in Pittsburgh and maybe they even end up at the Pit sometimes, but it's slightly different. But again, it's just one of those things that the show's great and it's a hit. Everybody loves it except some fans, but they love it too. They just don't love it the same way as the rest of us. That shows like this get franchised. I mean, it is actually part of being on television is that this stuff gets franchised. It's okay.
And HBO Max in some ways is going to sort of franchise this but not really, but they're doing a couple different pilots right now for shows that are in this sort of same model.
Oh, for sure.
I don't know if they're going to be real time, but so they're looking to do that too. But yeah, the question is when do they go to the creators and how much the creators get addicted to being Emmys? It'll be part of me thinks the best thing that could happen to the Pit is that it doesn't win the Emmy this year.
Right.
Just because I don't want them so worried about chasing Emmys. I want them just to continue making a great TV show mm-hmm. that happens to win Emmys.
Yeah. So it's a really good show, folks. I that's all I can say about it. It's one of the great shows. If you just does all those things for TV, I love it. One more little note that I wanted to throw in here, which is just I wanted to note the sad fate of Star Trek. They canceled Starfleet Academy. They already ended Strange New Worlds. Now, this doesn't mean there isn't going to be more Star Trek on TV because Strange New Worlds season 4 will premiere later this year. Starfleet Academy already shot season 2. That will run its final season presumably next year sometime. And there is a truncated 5th season of Strange New Worlds that will run presumably sometime late next year. So they've got 3 seasons of Star Trek in the can to take them through the end of next year, basically. But with the ownership changeover happening. I'm also the producer of Star Trek on TV, Alex Kurtzman. I think his contract is up this year. So there's the question of if they're going to renew that or not. They're trying to get a movie off the ground. I just wanted to mention, though, that there was this era of production for Star Trek on streaming that started with Star Trek Discovery. And it is at an end. They are no longer producing Star Trek. They're doing post-production, but there's like nothing in production now on Star Trek after that was all Les Moonves' whole thing about like they're getting international buyers to fund Star Trek Discovery before they even put it on CBS All Access. Well, we've come a long way since then, but they're kind of at a stopping point now.
For now. And look, Star Trek has its ups and downs, but you know what Star Trek needs to do? And this is probably the mistake is Star Trek needs to take the pit model, right? The problem with, I would argue, with Star Trek for streaming is that they really bought into the let's spend a gazillion
dollars. It's like a movie on the screen.
Exactly. And some of it looked great. And by the way, they didn't spend nearly as much as what Netflix spent on some of it. So it was still relatively modest. But instead of, you know, Discovery was like 10 episodes every like 2 years or whatever, 18 months or whatever, like find a way to make Next Generation again.
I agree.
You know, and they, by the way, they had a model out of the Picard thing that was all set there. Mm-hmm. And maybe new leadership, Cindy, will come in there and say, you know, let's do that, but let's adjust it. And I want 15 episodes and I want to air them weekly. And we're going to go for that audience. And this is your budget. You're not going to have the best special effects, but you're going to tell fun stories in space. Then maybe you can get people there again. We'll see.
I just had a conversation with somebody for a book project that they're doing about the BBC is going to do with Doctor Who. It's basically the same thing, which is that the nice thing about where we are with television is it's not peak TV anymore. You're not going to get a movie budget, but there's a lot of very good TV, even sci-fi, that can be done on a kind of a middle budget. And Star Trek, I think that's a great example where what you want to do. The thing is, Strange New Worlds, and they were talking about doing following it with a sort of like early days of Captain Kirk follow up like that, whether it's that or that the thing that keys off of Picard, the idea of like, let's put people on the Starship Enterprise and we'll give them a budget that's going to allow them to do not 8 or 10 episodes a year, but more like 15, and have it be, you know, that show that is super straightforward and everybody knows what it is, and give people enough of it so that they can watch it with a more reasonable budget. And like, I think it could be done. I don't know what's going on over there. But it's definitely a reset, right? Clearly, because there was a point where they had an animated show or a couple animated shows that they were doing. And live action shows, and there was a whole, like, they were trying to use that to fill a lot of space on Paramount Plus, and that has
ended. Same thing with Star Wars over at Disney too, right?
There,
you know, you've got now you're getting your TV shows are back to being movies.
And Marvel, with the same way. You get one or two a year maybe, and that's it.
Which is, by the way, probably the way it should be to some degree. But I think, you know what, I think I've just realized what the show for Star Trek it is. It's Star Trek meets the Pit. It's the space hospital. And it's somewhere, and you self-contain. It's just sort of like it's within the galaxy. You take the most the things that the whatever little, they're not called replicators, whatever they call the medical machines in Star Trek, but it's like they rush you. You gotta try exactly. Can it's just like you're being rushed in by space ambulance and your light speed, and you're coming. It's like warp speed is like, you know, and mass casualty is like where the worst cases in the galaxy come to heal.
Ellison on the phone. Joe's got a pitch for Star Trek.
Come on, Star Trek, the Pit. And by the way, my God, I just realized they own both. With the merger happens, they've actually owned the franchises.
I know,
wow.
Right? Beam Noah Wiley up. That's what I say.
It's the Dr. Robbie hologram. Mm-hmm. He's in there. He was so important that they actually made a
pop. He made a hologram. He'll never die now.
Or it could be Mexico. And you could have Bones Academy, maybe. It was like a little Dr. Bones, like you learn the Bones method. Yes.
Amazing.
I'm a doctor. Never mind.
These are great ideas. Before we go, I do like to do a TV picks thing. Do you have a TV show you'd like to recommend to people?
Oh, wow. That's right. The show I would like to recommend right now. Actually, yes. RJ Decker on ABC. You know, if you it's not a cozy mystery because it's not a single murder every week, but it is a cozy, you know, it's Scott Speedman, who will always be the guy from Felicity, but I think was also on Grey's Anatomy. I didn't watch him there. He is sort of basically a sort of Jim Rockford type. he's sort of
and this is a Carl Hiaasen, so it's a sleazy Florida show.
It's a sleazy Florida. It's sort of the show that Bad Monkey that Apple did on network TV budget.
Interesting.
And yet I love it even more. And only seen, there have only been 7 episodes, but they're getting better actually, as opposed to getting worse. And you've got a great, you know, he's wrongly, like Jim Rockford, he's out on parole, sort of, and sort of a crime he didn't really commit. He was sort of, you know, and there's lots of, there's a hot woman who's chasing him who has a bad dad. And it's just, but it's just case of the week, funky Florida, interesting crimes. There was an episode this week that was about, that tied to the Cuban Revolution and some refugees in Cuba. So there's a strong sense of place of Latinos in the mix there. It's just, it's well done, and it's just a nice cozy watch. And it's better than, honestly, in my mind, even than High Potential or some of those other sort of cozy crime shows that are out there. Is it must see TV? No, but it's really comfortable TV.
I like it. I like that idea. I'll have to check that out. I'm going to recommend For All Mankind, which is back on Apple TV. It's just a banana show about astronauts on Mars, and is there a revolution happening on Mars, and like there's politics and there's space disasters, and I love that they just do it, whatever and everything, and just keep trying.
There's a spinoff coming, right? There's a spinoff coming.
And there is a spinoff. I've seen the first couple episodes of that. I think I'm still under embargo, but like I've enjoyed it so far. That's all I'm going to say for now. But Star City, that's going to premiere as the season of For All Mankind ends. I think they're dropping the first two episodes of that. And then I'll throw out a shout out to Scrubs on ABC, which has managed to just bring a show back from the past, and it's still that show, which seems like it's obvious, but it's actually really hard to do. And I've enjoyed it. I enjoy the original Scrubs. And it's basically that again.
Yeah, I've only seen the first two or three episodes, but I was like, I actually like this, and I don't think I watched the last five seasons of Scrubs.
No, it got bad over time, as sometimes these things do. But no, I thought it was really, really well done, and the cast is obviously older, but now they have new young doctors in there who are learning, and like I think they just finished their first season, and hopefully that comes back because I really enjoyed it. I think they did a good job.
Yeah, it's got Bill Lawrence DNA. He, of course, is a producer, but it's sort of like, again, between RJ Decker and Scrubs, like ABC really doing well. It's sort of getting that Apple vibe on a network budget and a network standards. And you know what? Works for me.
I love it. Good times. All right. Well, that brings us to the end. You should, of course, go to Vulture and read Joe's stuff, and also subscribe to the Buffering newsletter, where Joe will send you things, beam them directly in your brain for free. And you can go downstreamfeedback.com if you want to send us a message. You can find me at sixcolors.com and at many other podcasts here at Relay and over at The Incomparable. And that ends this episode, but we will be back one more time in 2 weeks. Until then, thanks for being here, Joe.
Thank you, sir. As always, it's always a delight to be with you, Jason Snell. And I really appreciate you having me on your show.
I am so happy to have you and to be able to talk to you. See you in 2 weeks, everybody.